Across the country and in Illinois, deaths from opioid overdoses are at record highs. But state funding shortages have caused many addiction treatment providers to cut services or shut down entirely.
Lawmakers and people in the public in general need to remember that substance use disorders, they really are a disease, and it's not a moral or ethical failing of someone.
We begin our week-long series on the opioid crisis in Illinois. But first,
more typical than not, a man might wake up in the morning, look at himself in the mirror and go, hey, I think I could be a U.S. senator. And that recruitment process is very different.
That's Representative Sherry Bustos. We speak with her and the two women she helped recruit who just ran and won office for the first time. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, the Washington Post reported that President Trump revealed highly classified information to Russian officials in a meeting last week. Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin responded yesterday on Twitter saying, quote, "This is dangerous and reckless." This morning, Senator Durbin amplified those concerns on the Senate floor he just spoke about an hour ago.
This kind of disclosure is what former Director Comey and just about every other congressional Republican described last year as, quote, extremely reckless, close quote, in the handling of classified information. It jeopardizes critical intelligence sources in the fight against ISIL and the broader fight by America against terrorism. This morning, European officials reacted, told the Associated Press that at least one European country might stop sharing intelligence with the United States if this is how it's going to be treated. That is not, as Majority Leader described it this morning, quote, drama, close quote. This is a real consequence of a dangerous president putting American lives at risk. This is truly incredible and historic. It is a national security breach by the president of incredible proportions. How in the world can we trust the president to put the national security needs of the American people ahead of his own? There are a lot of parallels between the Watergate era and what we see today.
That's Senator Dick Durbin speaking just about an hour ago from the Senate floor in Washington. Durbin went on to call on Republicans to condemn this behavior and have an independent investigation and special prosecutor look into the matter. Stay tuned to this NPR station throughout the day for more reaction to this story. This past April, for municipal elections, there were a few gains by Democrats at the local level across Illinois, including Kankakee's first African-American mayor and Normal's first African-American council member. In the Chicago suburbs in Elgin, the council also went entirely for the Democratic Party. Democrats attribute this success in part to a few boot camps that were held by Representative Sherry Bustos. She's a Democrat representing Illinois' 17th district, which includes parts of Peoria and Rockford and the Quad Cities. In fact, 12 people who attended her boot camps ran for local seats. 8 of those people won. I caught up with Representative Bustos last Friday. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you. And it's probably worth noting that a 9th lost by one vote.
Yes.
Which is a heartbreaker for me. But yeah, we had some amazing success out of our Build the Bench program.
Right. One vote in Peoria. Now, you are the lone Democrat in the U.S. House outside of Chicago. Was that the idea behind Build the Bench?
Well, I'll tell you how this all started. The last election cycle, I was vice chair of recruitment for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which meant that I was helping to recruit candidates all over the country to run in districts that we had hoped we'd have success in. And what I found out way too often is that we would go to areas and we really had a difficult time attracting great candidates who fit their respective districts. Either their politics were out of sync or they had never held any office before and didn't know anything about running for office and were a little intimidated by the prospects of running for office. And So that's how this idea originated. It's like we should be doing a lot better being able to find all kinds of people to run for Congress or for that matter, any office. And so that is the genesis of Build the Bench.
And so what kind of practical nuts and bolts details do you think people maybe don't think about that you want to share with them or that you have shared with them with the Build Dementia program?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about how we have the program structured. It's an all-day boot camp, and I think boot camp's the perfect way to describe what this is. It starts at 8 in the morning, ends at 5 at night. I raise money to pay for this, so it doesn't matter what anybody's income level is. If they want to participate, it doesn't cost them 1 cent. So we provide breakfast. We provide lunch. We provide people who are, I think, the best in their category in Democratic politics anywhere in the country. They come in and present. The people participating will walk away with materials that they can refer back to. And then we offer ongoing counsel to people who are running. If they hit a snag, if they need advice, we offer that. The categories that we focus on are the nuts and bolts of being successful in running for office. And that is, you've got to make sure that you have a message, that you know how to talk in front of a group. We do little exercises to have people give their stump speech, or you can call it their elevator speech. You know, if you were riding in an elevator, what would be the your pitch to somebody from the first floor to the 10th floor? So we talk about that. We talk about digital media and social media, how you build that. That's increasingly important in running for office. We talk about how you have to be successful having the resources to run for office. You know, none of us like money in politics. It's the very distasteful part of this line of work, but you've got to have resources in order to get your messaging out. And we talk about building a grassroots operation and how you go door to door and are successful at that. So it's really, again, the people who go through this program will walk away at the end of the day, and they can be successful, but if they follow what we've taught them over the course of this boot camp.
Well, and when it comes to your background, you're someone who grew up around folks like Paul Simon and Dick Durbin. But I'm wondering what advice you give to people, especially women running for office. What's the most honest advice you've ever given them about the realities of what it takes to not just win, but hold public office?
Well, for winning, and let's even start at the recruitment phase, it is very different recruiting women than it is recruiting men. I mean, it is very, very different. Typically, the first question a woman will ask when I'll say, hey, I'd like to talk with you about running, and I don't care what level it is, for mayor, for Congress, or for city council. Typically, a woman will first ask, well, how is this going to impact my family?
Men don't ask that question. It's not the first
men
one.
Men typically do not ask that as their first question. That it would be atypical for a man to ask that as their first question, but it is very typical of a woman to ask that for her very first question. And then you'll hear, how do you take it when you're being criticized so publicly? How do you take that? And I just think it would be very, very hard to have all that public criticism out there. That's also a question that you don't get a lot from men, but a lot of women ask that. And I would say the other thing is, and I get this from women and I don't hear it from men as much, is, boy, the issues in Congress are so complex and so there's so many of them. How do you get on top of understanding all of those issues? And you know, so I throw this out there because more typical than not, a man will, you know, might wake up in the morning, look at himself in the mirror and go, hey, I think I could be a U.S. senator. And there's, you know, and it's, so that recruitment process is very different. And as far as, you know, women, when they are going through the election process or serving, you know, we still typically as women, we're still the person who has a heavier role in helping our children and raising our children and doing the housework still. I consider myself one of the luckiest people serving in Congress because I have a husband who is a tremendous partner in our relationship with whether it was raising our children. They're all grown now, but whether it was raising our three boys or making supper or cleaning the house. My husband did 50% and typically more than 50% of the work around our house. And I wouldn't have been able to do this without him. So I also always say that if you are in a relationship, having a supportive partner is absolutely critical to being successful because it's a very demanding line of work.
Representative Bustos, you're also co-chair of the Red to Blue initiative of the DCCC. That's the campaign arm of the Democratic Party. And obviously, you're in a district that spans both rural and urban areas. What do you think the Democratic Party is missing out on right now when it comes to rural voters?
Well, so in the last election cycle, that was one of the roles that I played. In addition to being involved in recruitment, I was also co-chair of this the Red to Blue committee. And what I'm spending the vast majority of my time this election cycle is to focus on these tough districts where perhaps Democrats used to do well and we haven't done as well, or where we've got a really good shot at winning back some of these seats. So we can pass legislation that is so helpful for working men and women and, you know, the families who work so hard and just are struggling to get ahead. And I believe we have the right policies for those, but we've got to have enough Democrats in the House and in the Senate to be successful. So what I focus on is what's worked for me. You pointed this out, but I'm in a district that Donald Trump won. And I'm also in a district where I won by 20 points. So, you know, if you look at the reality of that, that meant for every five people who walked into the voting booth in November, they voted for Donald Trump and they voted for me. And why is that? So what we consider some of our best practices that I'm sharing with all of my colleagues and anybody running is on Saturdays, I do something that we call Supermarket Saturdays. And all that is we go to the various supermarkets or grocery stores all around the 14 counties in my congressional district and 7,000 square miles. And while people are, you have moms walking up and down the aisles and they might be picking out their Frosted Flakes for their kids and dads buying their tangerines and grandpa's buying, paper plates or whatever it is they're buying. And I'm walking the aisles and I introduce myself and I just say, hey, I'm going to be flying back out to Washington on Monday. Tell me what's on your mind. And, you know, you get to know people and you listen a lot more than you talk. So we do that. We try to do that virtually every Saturday. And then the other thing that we do is we call it Sherry on Shift. And all that is I job shadow people all over my congressional district and see exactly what they do to make a living, how they support their families, their struggles. You get to know them and you know, I'll ask them questions about, you know, were they able to take a vacation last year? I ask them what they do for fun, and it tells a lot about people's discretionary income and the challenges that they have in their families. They'll tell me whether they've gotten a raise in the last 5 years or if they haven't. And so I guess really what I'm saying is it's showing up, it's listening, and then going. When I go back out to Washington, I sponsor legislation or I write legislation that helps address what I've learned in these Supermarket Saturdays and these Sherry on Shifts that I do.
That was Representative Sherry Bustos. I spoke with her on Friday afternoon. I'm joined on the line now by two women who won local elections in Illinois last month after attending those boot camps. Kimberly Cummings is a member of the Normal Town Council, and Arlene Jose is a Normal Township trustee. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to be here.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us. I should point out to our audience right now that in the interest of full disclosure that the general manager of one of our partner stations, R.C. McBride, is also on the Normal Town Council. It's also important for our audience to know that none of the general managers of any of our partner stations have editorial input into the 21st. We are editorially independent. That aside, ladies, I'd love to talk to you about why you decided to run for office. Councilwoman Cummings, let's start with you. What motivated you to go to this boot camp to begin with?
So I've always had a passion for politics. Actually got my degree in political science, so my start into it began long ago. Timing being right, I decided to run for Town of Normal City Council this past year. Was just often running with my campaign. Little struggles, still relatively, I guess, fresh to the community in a sense. Only being here for 5 years, it was an opportunity for me to be able to pick up the pace in my campaign and learn some different techniques in getting out here and getting my name out in the community. So I became interested in the boot camp and that's how I, what made or led me to make the decision to go and see what I could learn.
And be, what were the, some of those techniques that you picked up?
Sherry actually talked about them a little bit in her interview that she did with you last Friday, and one of them was the stump.
Oh, the elevator speech, right.
Yeah. Or the elevator speech where 2 minutes, you know, we had 2 minutes to be able to get our point across and share a message with our, with the residents as you are out canvassing and going door to door. And I think that one helped most tremendously. Secondly, they went over how to successfully run a social media campaign. And that really helped me quite a bit in this election cycle.
Can you give us a 15-second version of what your stump speech was?
Oh, sure. I would go to the door and let everybody know that it was time to move forward, and time meant for transparency, inclusion, multifaceted economic development, and enthusiastic engagement.
That is Normal Town Council, one of the newest members of Normal Town Council, Kimberly Cummings. We have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to also hear from Normal Township Trustee Arlene Jose, and we're going to hear her story, both of them women who decided to run for office, just one. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. By the way, you can always join our conversation by tweeting at us. Our handle is 21STShow. That's 21st Show. Follow us during the show. We also tweet out more background and context about what we're talking about. We'll pick up this conversation just after the break. Stay tuned to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. We've been talking about efforts to get more women to run for office, spearheaded by Democratic Representative Sherry Bustos. 12 women who attended her boot camps that she ran earlier this year ran for office in last month's local elections. 8 of them won. One of them, as we heard her point out, lost by one vote in Peoria. We have two of those newly minted officials with us now. Normal Town Council Councilwoman Kimberly Cummings and Normal Township Trustee Arlene Jose. Trustee Jose, can you tell us what motivated you to run for office?
I had thought about running for office for several years, and then late in or during the spring of May 2016, I decided, well, maybe I won't do that at this time in my life. And then the election happened, to be honest with you, and as I was grappling with the emotions and the thoughts following our November 8th election, a friend approached me about the opportunity to run for town for Normal Township. And he had known that I was interested in running in the past. And so at that time, I decided, you know, I can no longer sit on the sidelines. I need to be a part of the process if I really want to ensure that this community is a community that I feel that I can thrive in and that others feel the same way. So that's really what prompted me, was the election and thinking about what I could do to make a difference in my community.
We were just hearing Councilwoman Cummings talk about Representative Bustos in the boot camp, a lot of different techniques that she learned for social media, for perfecting sort of her introductory speech. I wonder, Trustee Jose, what did Representative Bustos tell you about the challenges of running for office, especially being a woman doing so?
Well, you heard some of that in the conversation that you had with her last Friday. For me, it was making sure that my family would be supportive, and those friends that were close to me would be supportive. So it really entailed sitting down and having that conversation with my husband, talking about our grandchildren that lived in town, and what the impact would be having a mom who was going to be 90 this year, and what changes would that mean for her and the amount of activity or time that I could spend with her and the things that I did.
So you were really thinking about all generations of your family, your children and grandchildren, as well as your mother.
Yes, because my family dynamic is that we are so close and we are always there for one another. And so I wanted to make sure that what I was doing would not impact the way that family dynamic worked. And the support that I received from my family and friends was just amazing. They wanted me to take this step. So that made it a lot easier for me. And being retired meant that I didn't have to juggle a job responsibility and running for office or being elected and having the demands of a job. So that was a fortunate piece for me as well. It may be different for someone that is still working and has little children at home or maybe a single parent.
Councilwoman Cummings, what about you? How much did your family and your work life, I imagine you still have a day job, how did all of that factor into your decision as well?
I definitely had to take a look at all of those things before I actually run. The first conversation I had was with my husband, and also we prayed about it because, you know, we had to make sure that it was the right thing to do at the right time for us as a family or family unit, and especially us considering one day having children and, you know, not having any at this current time. We had to take a look at, you know, what that would do and factor those into our plans. Also work, you know, I had to have conversations and say, hey, this is something I'm interested in. This is something I'm passionate about. You know, how do we make this work? And so all those things, and then not to mention all the different things I'm already a part of and have been committed to, how do you make those work and continue to be active within those realms? And so you definitely have to consider all those entities. And I agree with Representative Bustos when she talks about, as women, those are the things that come first to mind for us when we make the decision or even consider running for office.
Mm-hmm. Trustee Jose, I wanted to ask you, you're the first African-American trustee for Normal Township. What does that mean for you and for your family? I'm thinking about, you were just talking about your 90-year-old mother.
Well, I have to say it means a lot to my family. My family migrated here in 1918 to the Twin Cities, specifically Bloomington. And the sense of pride and the sense of a Jose being elected to a position here in this community, we have a history of being my grandfather and his father-in-law being part of the rail yard system here. And so being elected meant a lot for my family, a sense of pride. We've been first. My aunt was the first African-American cheerleader for Bloomington High School, and her older brother played football and was a co-captain of the Bloomington football team. And when we had my swearing in, my dad's oldest brother was here because my dad is deceased, and his younger sister was here, and they were able to sit and watch this historic moment for me. And that really was all the generations of my family were there, to the four-year-old great-niece. So it's a very much a sense of pride for my family, and it really does make the history that we've had in this community even more deep.
Councilwoman Cummings, I wanted to ask you, you were also, both of you, this is my last question for both of you, you were just sworn in earlier this month. What are your priorities now that you're an elected official? Councilwoman?
I think one of my priorities, number one, would definitely be to learn as much as I possibly can. You know, there are certain things that you know, even having a degree in then there's things that you don't know. And how do I get to know those things so that I could be most effective for my community? And then next is, you know, just digging in. There are so many things that we need to take a look at. We have to be mindful of, you know, we continuously want to grow our economic development, find jobs for our community so that we can increase the workforce here. And so, you know, I want to be able to be a part of making or moving us forward in those areas.
Trustee Jose, what are your first priorities?
Well, I've started making sure that I meet the staff of our township office. I've been out to our activity and recreation center, which is a big part of the township, and will be going back there to walk around and reintroduce myself to staff and talk with those who utilize the facility. And like Kimberly, just really getting in and learning as much as I can about the township from a local level, but also how townships work within our McLean County. We have a boot camp on our township state website that we can participate in, so I plan to do that. There's an upcoming training in August that I won't be able to attend, but I'm hoping to be able to travel outside of my community to attend that training, just really getting to know what we can do to make sure community members know who I am, know who we are, and what we do and how to serve them, and really just getting out and getting personal, making sure people know me and they know who I am, and hearing their comments.
That's Arlene Jose. I'd also like to thank Kimberly Cummings, both of them newest members of Normal Township Trustee and Normal Town Council. Thank you so much, both of you, for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For roughly a decade, state funding for addiction treatment and mental health facilities in Illinois has been steadily declining. All the while, the need has only increased, especially as we've seen more people becoming addicted to opioid prescription pain medications and seeking treatment. Factor in the past 2 years of Illinois not having a budget, and the funding situation for addiction treatment facilities is even more dire. Many facilities have reduced services. A few have had to shut their doors entirely. Most recently, the Well Center in Jacksonville was forced to lay off 33 employees and close a 32-bed facility that had operated for nearly 50 years, serving 500 clients per year. They were owed $1.4 million from the state. That's according to reporting from Dean Olson, who covers healthcare for the State Journal Register in Springfield. He's on the line now to help us learn more. Dean, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Dean, what happened? What led to the Well Center closing their doors? Was that the first week of May that happened?
That's correct. The Well Center basically had been going through a lot of problems even since the beginning of the budget impasse. In October of 2015, a couple of months after the impasse began, they closed a medically supervised detox unit, which was 6 beds. It served 350 people a year and laid off about 11 people. And that was kind of the tip of the iceberg in the closing situation. So keep in mind that in the years before the impasse started, in the 5 to 7 years before that, state funding for drug addiction treatment had dropped 30% or more to Well Center and other places. So they were dealing with that. And so this was an additional blow to Well Center. So they're a smaller center. They're standalone, so they don't have a lot of cash flow where they can deal with these big fluctuations in payments.
So, Dean, what are the patients who had been receiving treatment? What's happening now?
I think it just means that access to these centers is more difficult. There are two centers in Springfield. The biggest one, see, Jacksonville is about 45 minutes away from Springfield. And in Springfield, Gateway Foundation has a big treatment center. And it recently opened an additional outpatient facility to handle this because they've seen a total turnaround of the types of patients they serve in the past 5 years. They used to serve mostly alcoholics, and now they serve the majority are people addicted to prescription painkillers and heroin. And so they often have to turn away people. During all of these changes and reductions in state funding, Gateway, along with many of other providers, has decided that they're going to take more paying patients, meaning people with private insurance, just to survive because they can't deal with the state continuing to cut their funding. So they have fewer beds available for the poor people who are either on Medicaid or uninsured. And so when a place like Wells Center closes, the burden on the other centers increases, and they often cannot take everybody as they come. And anybody in addiction treatment will tell you that the best time to treat someone and take them in is when they present to your door. When you cannot immediately serve them, you lose a critical piece of a critical opportunity when you can serve them. That means they leave. In the next day or two, they might return to using, and then they're just in the cycle again, and the risk of them dying is really high. So we've had many anecdotal reports of deaths happening or people returning to addiction as a result of this. So at a time when the need is the greatest, with the heroin epidemic and prescription opioids on the upswing, the social service safety net for in Illinois is really badly frayed.
That's Dean Olson. He's a reporter. He covers healthcare for the State Journal Register. As always, those of you listening are welcome to join our conversation with your questions or comments. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your comments as well to 21st Show. That our handle's 21ST Show. We wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. Sarah Howe is the CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. They represent more than 60 providers across the state. Sarah, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Sarah, as Dean is talking about this and we're hearing the frankly horrific consequences of the lack of funding, I wanted to ask you something, because our 21st staff spent quite a bit of time reaching out to providers across the state. And to be frank with you, we had a really hard time getting providers who specifically are struggling to come on air and talk to us. Why is there a reluctance on behalf of providers who, like the Wells Center, places that are shutting down, to be public about what's going on with them?
I think there's a number of reasons why that is the case. So the first is many of these agencies are grounded in their communities. They've been serving the community for many years. They certainly don't want the community to think that they are not committed to the work that they're doing. That's, you know, I think, first and foremost. The other piece of this is, you know, the staff. I mean, they have a staff that they need to take care of, that they are trying to maintain every day, growing caseloads. With the work that they do, they don't make a lot of money doing it, and it's difficult work, and it's very rewarding, but it's certainly difficult work. So you certainly don't want your staff hearing on the radio that your organization is potentially struggling, is potentially shutting down. They may close a program. It's just not the best business practice for them. So what we try to do as an association is gather that information anonymously, find out what is happening. How can we try to get this information to the legislators and to the general public about the struggle that we are seeing? But you're right. You're probably in a position where you're not going to hear an agency say in a very public way, well, we are 30 days out from closing our doors, 60 days out. They don't want that out in the papers. And, of course, if they can stop that before it starts, certainly they're going to try to do that.
That's Sarah Howe. She's the CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about the opioid crisis in Illinois. By the way, if you or someone you know needs help, the National Helpline for Substance Abuse and Mental Health is 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-HELP. Stay tuned. The 21st will continue in just a minute. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. All this week on the program, we're going to be talking about the opioid crisis as it is across Illinois. Here's some troubling statistics from the CDC. Opioids kill more than 90 Americans every day. This number has quadrupled over the past two decades. We're looking at how Illinois has been affected by this nationwide epidemic. And today we're focusing in on how state funding issues over not just the past 2 years, but recent years have made it difficult for service providers across the state. My guests are Sarah Howe, the CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health, and Dean Olson, who covers healthcare for the State Journal Register in Springfield. I also want to bring in the CEO, Gail Rainey, of the Prairie Center in Urbana, who's also joining us for this conversation. Gail, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
As always, those of you who are listening are welcome to join us. You can share your questions or comments. You can tweet them to 21st Show. You can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-222-9455. Sarah, let me ask you, what parts of the state do you think have been hit hardest by this crisis? And then, of course, sort of the dual crisis we're talking about here, right? Not just the number of people suffering from addiction problems with opioid, being addicted to different opioids, but also then the state funding and how that's been affecting things. Where are we seeing this being the toughest part of the state?
Questions there. The first, the state funding piece is across the board, across the state. Every provider that I speak with is struggling because of the state funding. When you're talking about heroin and opioids, it really started, when we really started to see the epidemic, it was mostly in the Chicago suburbs, in the St. Louis metro area. That's not the case anymore. It's not just in those two areas. It is really spread across the state. There isn't a provider that I talk to anymore that is not seeing their admissions for heroin go up. At the same time, though, the total admissions to treatment are going down because of the state budget crisis. Just from 2013 to 2016, there were almost 25,000 fewer admissions to state treatment across the state for state-funded treatment, and that's a direct result of the budget crisis. So that's at the same time admissions for heroin are going up. We're getting many more calls across the state. The numbers are going down for being able to get people in the doors.
Gail, is that what you're also seeing at the Prairie Center in Urbana?
Definitely. Since the state funding crisis began, or the state budget crisis, I should say, we've had a funding crisis at Prairie Center since 2007. We've actually lost $1.5 million in treatment funding from the state since 2007. That's about 50% of our state funding.
Wow. You've lost half of your state funding. What percentage does that represent of your overall budget?
Roughly, we currently have a $4.5 million budget. So our board of directors has given me the directive to not be as reliant on the state for our funding. And so we have been doing that and diversifying our funding. So thankfully, we find ourselves in a little bit different position than some of the other providers in the state. But because of other providers having to close services, we're seeing longer wait lists because we're having to serve some of the people that they would have served in the past. For example, Dean talked earlier about the Wells Center having to close its residential facility earlier this year. And we actually took some of those clients and gave them a bed at our facility.
So people from the Springfield area, you're helping treat in Urbana.
Exactly. We actually see clients from across the state.
Because there's no other place for them to go?
Correct.
Sarah, when an agency has to reduce services, which typically are the first ones they cut?
Recently, what I have seen cut the most is detoxification services. I think in central Illinois, and Gail, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we are at maybe two or three agencies total in all of central Illinois that have detox services. Oftentimes, that's the first service we see. They come in for 3 to 4 days for detox before they get into a program, whether that's outpatient or inpatient. We have seen detox go down across the state, and particularly in central Illinois, where we've been hardest hit with a loss of detox services.
And Gail, you all had to cut your detox program at Prairie Center, is that correct?
Correct. In 2011, we had to close our detox because of the lack of state funding. That center provided, was a 10-bed detoxification center, and we served approximately 600 people from across the state each year. Right now,
yeah.
People in our area actually...
What are they doing?
Yeah, they actually have to go roughly 80 miles away to get detox services for any kind of publicly funded detox. And a lot of people are either going to the emergency rooms locally or they're actually trying to detox on their own, which is very unsafe.
Sarah, what does happen? Are people traveling, as Gail saying? Especially when you're talking about opioids in particular, heroin is such a difficult drug to detox from. I wonder if you could describe how different that is from, say, other drugs that people might be less familiar with.
Well, I think, and I'll let Gail, the clinical expert here, as a treatment provider, but I will say that I think the number one drug of choice we have seen in this state and in this country for years is alcohol, and it has been alcohol. What is really concerning to all of us is the admissions for heroin and opioids are starting to outpace alcohol for the first time in our history. That in and of itself is astounding because alcohol, really, we're not going to change the fact that alcohol is the number one drug of choice. Yet, right now, as we know that we have an epidemic that's been labeled an epidemic by the CDC, we are seeing many more people come in for heroin and opiates across the state. And again, you know, to answer your question about what really happens, people will call every facility they possibly can. Certainly, they want to try to get treatment in their local area. But if that's not available, they'll call the next city and the next city. And sometimes they will travel, whether it's in-state or, unfortunately, sometimes people will try to go out of state. But, Gail, I'll let you jump in.
Yeah, Gail,
about,
from a
you know,
clinical
really
standpoint, yeah, I would, Gail, from a clinical standpoint, I'd love for you to explain to people. I think people, especially people who aren't familiar with this, maybe have misconceptions about detoxing from, say, alcohol and people being able to do that on their own. Is that even possible with opioids?
Well, I need to correct you a little bit. Detoxing from alcohol is actually very dangerous. Detoxing from alcohol and alcohol withdrawal can actually cause death. And a lot of people don't know that. So we need to get that message out there as well. It's very unsafe to try to detox on your own from alcohol. With heroin and opioids, it doesn't necessarily always lead to death, but the issue with withdrawal there is it's very, very painful. What a person goes through from withdrawing from opioids is just horrible for their system. And what often happens then is if they can't find a place that can help them with those symptoms, they'll just go back to using so that they don't feel as bad. And so the cycle begins again.
Dean, I wonder if I could bring you back into this conversation. Dean Olson covers healthcare for the State Journal Register in Springfield. Dean, you said something before the break about the fact that a lot of treatment centers, and as we're focusing particularly on detox before we get to the treatment as well, how much of people rely on paying customers? And you mentioned Medicaid, and I wanted to ask you just given if you could put this in the context of we've been talking about the state funding, but I wonder if we also need to talk about the proposed American Healthcare Act, AHCA, all of the recent talk about repealing Obamacare. How would that affect Illinois' ability to provide treatment for drug addiction?
Well, when the Affordable Care Act was passed, that was hailed as a potential boon for people with addictions because they used to have to depend, if they had no insurance, on state funding to these treatment centers. And like you found with the Champaign-Urbana area and in Springfield, those dollars had been winnowed down. The state decided to spend less and less on that. So it was viewed that Medicaid expansion in Illinois would bring insurance, some sort of insurance, to lots of addicts who might have lost their job or had no insurance. So in theory, that could help them. In practice, it's been difficult for the providers to get reimbursement through Medicaid because of the simultaneous implementation by the state of Medicaid managed care. The managed care networks operated by private companies that contract with the state often were denying coverage or denying access by those treatment centers to their networks or making it difficult for them to get in. So what I'm hearing is that that is improving. So many more treatment centers are able to get reimbursement for those folks, and so they're more likely to admit them, okay? So, but at the same time, the plan by Republicans in Congress with the American Healthcare Act would block grant Medicaid. It would no longer become an entitlement, which means the increase in spending through Medicaid for problems that pop up, like heroin addiction, that the increase would be capped. And so when you have an increase in need for one area of healthcare, other parts get crowded out. And so there's less money available to spend. So it's estimated that if this law comes into being, that will be a tremendous step backward in the treatment community, because basically the Medicaid expansion would be repealed, likely at the state level. It basically would nullify it. And so many of those people would lose insurance again. And so we'd be back to where we were 6-7 years ago. And many of those people would be uninsured. And so treatment centers, which have already downsized in how they treat the poor just to survive because of the lack of appropriations from the state, they would have a diminished capacity to serve the uninsured. And so at a time when the heroin epidemic and opioid epidemic is on the upswing, we may be cutting people off at the knees as far as their ability to become insured and their ability to get access, relative quick access to treatment. So it's in the way of like a perfect storm in a bad way.
And as you talk about that perfect storm, Dean, Sarah, as CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health, I know you're traveling to Springfield tomorrow to speak with lawmakers. There's an advocacy day along with service providers. First, the stopgap budget expired on January 1st. Have addiction treatment providers, have they received payments since then?
If they've received payments, it is for any services that have been rendered prior to January 1st. Currently providing, there is no legal method to pay them for any state funding. So if they're continuing to provide services as best they can, but they have not gotten any dollars, state-funded dollars, since January 1st.
And Sarah, I'm afraid we're almost out of time, but I wonder if very quickly you could tell us what message you want to send to lawmakers tomorrow.
We need a budget, period, end of discussion. We absolutely need a budget. We need folks to come together, come to the table, and craft a budget. This is literally killing people every day.
Gail, what do you want citizens, people, residents, people in Illinois to know about this issue?
I think the biggest thing is to not see addiction as a moral failing. Someone who has an addiction, whether it be to opioids or any other drug, it's a disease, and we need to support those people in finding the care and the support that they need to be able to overcome this disease. It's a long journey for a person to get into recovery, and the more support that we can give them, the better off they are. A lot of people aren't even seeking the treatment they need because they're worried about the stigma attached to it, and that's another barrier in addition to all the funding issues that we've been talking about. So if our public can support the people that need the help, that's another way that we can, that's something that people can easily do without the money.
I want to thank Gail Rainey, the CEO of the Prairie Center in Urbana, joining us from our studios at WILL. I want to thank also Sarah Howe and Dean Olson from Springfield. Dean's with the State Journal Register. Sarah with the CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. All of you, thank you for joining me to talk about this important issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you or someone you know needs help, as we've said before, that National Helpline for Substance Abuse and Mental Health is 1-800-662-HELP. Tomorrow, we're continuing our series on the opioid crisis in Illinois to take you inside of the treatment and recovery process. We're going to meet a patient who's recently come out of a 28-day treatment center in Bloomington and learn about evidence-based methods for helping patients recover from addiction. If you or someone you know has been affected by opioid addiction, you would like to join our conversation, please share your story with us. You can leave a voicemail on our hotline. That's 217-300-2121. Again, that's 217-300-2121. All the information about how to contact us is also at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting from the Dill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.